The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance
on News Talk.
My next guest is no stranger to the world of politics and media. In fact, her TV debut was at the age of just 13. Terry Prone has become a household name across media and politics in Ireland over the past 50 years. And in her latest memoir, she recounts her career working with different political parties and giant figures like Charles Haughey and Garrett Fitzgerald. The book is called I'm Glad You Asked Me That. And here to tell me all about it is the woman herself, Terry Prone. Good morning and welcome.
Thank you, sir.
Now, the title of the book, I'm Glad You Asked Me That, which is advice that you never gave.
Absolutely. But from the very word go, we were accused of two things. One was telling particularly politicians to say, I'm glad you asked me that question, particularly if the question was a zinger. And secondly, that we told people to smile at the end of their sentences, neither of which we did. And it's always puzzled me why people wanted us to be teaching people not just tricks, but bad tricks. Because where we came from was a man named Bunny Carr, big television personality at the time.
Stop the lights.
Yeah, exactly. And RTÉ decided he'd be a really good presenter of a programme called The Politicians. And Bunny was fine, but the politicians concentrated on not saying anything interesting, on being full of clichés, parroting the party line. And then when Bunny would take them for a drink afterwards in a local pub, one of them invariably would say to Bunny, well, now you didn't get much out of me, did you? And this mystified Bunny because he was thinking, this is the best opportunity you're ever going to have, you politicians, to be seen by the nation, heard, and you're congratulating yourself on not saying anything. So we set out from the word go to make sure that people gave added value, that they actually went on radio or television programmes determined to offer stuff.
Now, you have a kind of a mantra that you have to be memorable. What else?
Interesting, understandable and memorable. Because the first thing is, if you're not interesting, let's say somebody's listening in their car, they're going to switch to another channel. If you're not understandable, they may be impressed with you, but they'll also switch channel. And if you're not memorable, why did you bother your arse going on at all? So those are the three things that are absolutely essential. And those three are often in competition with what advisors are telling their clients, particularly in politics, because political advisors always want the politician to be, to have gravitas, you know. And gravitas, it's very difficult to combine with being interesting, understandable.
Why does Michael O'Leary get rave reviews, even if you don't agree with anything he says?
Exactly. And if you think about it, in America at the moment, if you look at Kamala Harris, she never understood how to be interesting, understandable and memorable. By golly, we may not like him. Trump does.
He's certainly memorable, that's for sure. Now, in the early days of television, the trickery was there. I mean, we're in the throes of a presidential campaign at the moment, and I'll ask you in advance of Friday what advice you would give to both candidates to maximise their vote. But De Valera played a really cool trick when he was running for his second term.
He totally did, because in theory Fine Gael were going to walk it because they had a much younger candidate named O'Higgins. He had seven children. He had a glamorous wife. And this was after the Kennedy thing where Camelot had happened.
If I can borrow the phrase, he was no John F. Kennedy.
Well, this is true, but let's be kind. There was a sense that this was going to be a really Camelot kind of election. And De Valera, the old fox, looked at this and decided, nah, I'm not going to allow television to compare me and him. And so he pulled rank and said that he was the president already. He couldn't possibly.
Inappropriate to be campaigning.
Exactly. And this didn't mean that he stopped campaigning. Of course he didn't stop campaigning. He went to the RDS. He went to every event that the president should be at. He was photographed.
And more.
And more, yes. And he was everywhere, and yet he was not being asked any rude questions. And so he didn't exactly romp home. In fact, I suspect that it's the nearest that Fine Gael have ever come to winning a presidential election.
But the rub here was that RTE, the fledgling television station, decided that if we're not covering the president's campaign, he doesn't want to, there is no campaign, then we can't really cover the O'Higgins campaign either, can we?
It was, I mean, RTE...
Well, talk about a stroke.
Absolutely, because RTE, and RTE has always had problems with the concept of balance. There is this notion that, for example, you must have A in the studio and B in the studio. If B isn't in the studio, you have to apologise for them. It's all a nonsense. But what RTE did in that instance was play completely into the playbook of a clever, clever old man who didn't grow up with television, but he knew how to manipulate media.
And given the centenary, or sorry, the 50-year anniversary of 1916, and he was, of course, very much part and parcel of that, there were rather more events that he had to be present at than otherwise.
He was ever-present and a benign ever-presence.
So that brings me to the two current presidential candidates and what advice you would give them at this late point in the campaign to maximise their votes.
I don't think any advice will help change anything for either of them. I think that they need to... You see, one of the things that you have to look at when you're deciding on giving advice to politicians is you don't want them to be aiming at the people who will never vote for them. You don't want them to be aiming at the people who will definitely and always vote for them. You're looking at the bunch in the middle.
And that was Tom's specialty, wasn't it?
That was Tom Savage's belief that you really had to decide, no, no, these are the people who might change their votes if they're hit with something that really reaches them emotionally. And I'd be saying to both candidates, that's the only thing you should be looking at. Don't look at reinforcing the already on your side. Don't look at attacking the people who'll never be on your side. Just look, is there anything that would move a floater? And in this instance, not just to vote for you, but to vote at all, because the real danger this time around is that we'll have a phenomenally low vote.
Now, the old trick which they find on the canvas all the time, say a Labour household, so they preoccupy the Fine Gaeler or the Fianna Fáil or the Sinn Féiner forever on the doorstep, knowing they will never give any of them a vote because they're dyed-in-the-wool Labour Party. But that keeps the canvassers busy and ineffective.
Oh, yes. And the greatest living expert that I have ever seen on this is Bertie Hearn. I remember watching Bertie giving an hour-long talk to canvassers before a particular election and thinking, wow. And he nailed that thing of, don't be distracted, don't go in and have cups of coffee and a bun. That's time that you should be spending out on the canvas. But also, and this is something that's so important now, when every telephone amounts to social media, he said, never have an argument on the canvas. Never have an argument. He said, you can prove the voter wrong. Absolutely. You can humiliate them. It's not often that you get somebody who's been proven wrong and humiliated who'll actually subsequently vote for you.
There is a problem, though, these days, if you decide I'm going to kick for touch here and say I'm sorry. There are so many mobile phones around that your sorry is going to be viral in jig time.
It has changed everything. And one of the things that has been said about this particular election is that questions haven't been answered. And that's a particular problem for people like you, as well as people out on the canvas, because as this election has gone on, and you did the debate how many days ago?
9 days ago.
9 days ago. as in the ensuing 9 days, the same questions have been asked all the time. And that means the electorate is getting bored, and even bored by the fact that in some cases the questions haven't been answered.
Yeah, getting an answer when you ask someone a yes or no question. And I mean, I watch Pam Bondi in the United States doing precisely the same thing before the Oversight Judicial Committee and got away with it.
Yes. That's a thing that astonishes me, that we have reached a point where trickery has come back into play. I regret that deeply.
Now, you've trained them all virtually. Mm-hmm. I mean, you write in your book about training Garrett Fitzgerald, which was like herding wasps.
What a great description. We've trained my company down the years. We've trained the Progressive Democrats, Labour, the Greens, Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael. We would be the only company that's done that. And Garrett was, Peter Prendergast from Fine Gael copped on early that Garrett needed herding. I don't think Peter Prendergast had any clue as to how much herding Garrett would need and how unprofitable the herding would be. Because, first of all, you weren't even sure that Garrett would arrive in the right place. On one occasion, he went to another set of studios, which absolutely terrified the poor devils down there. The second thing was, he would do things that were ill thought out. For example, he came into us just before a big debate, and he handed me what I thought was a wilted bunch of flowers. And I'm looking at, and then I realise that it's about 8 ties. And his wife has just handed him these ties and told him to get me to pick, like I know anything about ties. But I had to then go away and find a way to iron or steam these ties because he had clutched them with such force that they were all creased. Then you would sit down and you would say, OK, we're going to record. An hour later, you were still ready to record, but Garrett would be discussing some abstruse point of economics with one of his advisors because he had, curiously, even though he had a brilliant mind, it was an oddly undisciplined mind. And
I was at breakfast in Brussels one time. There was a summit on and Garrett was there and Peter Prendergast was there. And Peter came down for breakfast. And it was announced that he'd had an accumulator. He was a racing man. He loved betting. And he had an accumulator the previous day. You know, the first horse won at 4-1. The second one had won at 7-2. The third one had won at maybe 20-1. The fourth one at 11-4 on. And so on and so forth. And Garrett said to him, "How much have you won?" He says, "I don't know." "Well, hang on a second," says Garrett. And gets out the envelope and doesn't use a calculator, but he works out exactly how much Peter had won on the horses. Instead of talking about the meeting with Margaret Thatcher on the fringes of the summit, etc., etc.
He was impossible. And, I mean, he was adorable. But if you agreed after an assessment, okay, you are sure that these three issues are the one, and these are the illustrations, these are the examples. If he would agree, he would repeat the words, everything. And then he would go into the studio and you were very lucky if 20% of what you had agreed with him actually ensued.
Did you ever get a chance to tutor Charles J. Haughey?
Oh, yes. This was because John O'Connell, Dr. John, was an old, old friend of mine. And he kept ringing me and saying, Terry, CJ has to come out to you. And I'm saying, John, Charles Haughey hates us because he regards us as having worked with Garrett. And he had, we believed, his own studio and all sorts of people. And John O'Connell, who had moved from Labour to Fianna Fáil, kept saying, no, I'll get him to come out to you. And I'm thinking, two chances, John. And then one morning he rang me and said, "Do you remember?" And I said, "Yeah." And he said, "Well, he'll see you." And I said, "Oh, when?" And he said, "Now. I'll pick you up in half an hour." So this was after I had had a god-awful car crash. So I still most of the time in a wheelchair. I grabbed crutches. John drove out to Kinsealy. And we went into this beautiful, beautiful Gandon mansion. And I was on the crutches. And as we crossed the main hallway, Haughey pointed to the carpet, the rug, and said that that was a gift of Colonel Gaddafi. Okay. So then we moved into his studio and he asked me to give him an assessment of each of his front bench in media terms. And I did. And then I realised, Pat, that his chair, do you know, it was one of these spinny chairs. His chair was moving sideways so that he was moving into profile rather than watching me. And I thought, hump this for a haircut. And I just shut up. And he said, you're depressing me. And I said, well, look at it this way, Mr. Haughey, you're getting it for free. And at that moment, John O'Connell stood up and began to tell Haughey how important media was. And I glanced down and John had two mismatched shoes on.
This is the stuff of like Gareth Fitzgerald.
Exactly. Yeah. And I thought, John, God love you. You are so frightened of this man that you didn't even notice you had the wrong shoes. But he still had the courage to stand up. But Haughey listened to him and then led us out the door. And I said to John, look, I'm sorry. I'm sorry, but I'm going to tell the truth if I'm asked. And then I realised that John was beaming. And 3 weeks later, we had a course with CJ. And Bunny Carr was supposed to do the interview with them and we got all the research ready. And Bunny got the bends. He actually felt it would be some kind of a mortal sin for him to interview Haughey.
Was he a true blue?
I don't
know. Finnegaler.
I think he was actually asked to run by Labour, Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael at different stages. I don't think he was. I think he was a Garrett fan. He felt that having worked with Garrett, and Tom, my husband, said, okay, go home, we'll deal with it. And I sat into the chair. Haughey arrived, sat into the other chair, and we started to roll. And I did a very careful interview with him. You know, the Jessica Mitford thing of you start by asking the easy questions and when somebody has begun to relax, you ask the more difficult ones and you don't have to ask them in a performative way. So I asked him about Terry Keane and the affair with Terry Keane, which nobody had ever, this is 50 years ago, ever referred to before. And he made an absolute cobbler's of the answer. I asked him about Colonel Gaddafi's carpet since I'd been on it. And when I reached the end and said, Mr. Haughey, thank you, I had said to the cameramen, and there were two guys, keep it rolling. And they kept it rolling. And what was recorded was Haughey leaning across, catching me by the knee and saying, you are a rude bitch. But the fascinating thing was that although he was raging, he kind of appreciated it at the same time.
Did he learn?
Oh, did he learn? He was possibly the ultimate politician. Once he broke through in the beginning, he kept telling me what criticisms I was going to make. And it took him quite a while to understand the difference between an assessment and criticism. Any fool can criticise. An assessor doesn't criticise unless they know how to help the person out of the problem that they were in. Can I give you an example? Charlie Haughey was always trying to impress. He was oddly socially unsure. And so he always...
And was that like because he was a Joey's Christian Brothers boy rather than, you know, from one of the private schools?
I don't know why it was, but I do know that, for example, he brought in great legislation about artists and tax relief, but his own grasp of the arts was very thin. Very thin. Even if you think of the line he used at the end when he was leaving power, I have done the state some service. Pat, that's pure leaving cert. Mm-hmm. That's pure leaving cert. But anyway, I was explaining to him that if you use big, long sentences, if you use conceptual English, an example, if I say to you, social outlets for otherwise antisocial tendencies are societally valuable. You, because you're a genius, are going to...
No, I've glazed over already, Terry.
But people hearing it live on radio or television, are going to go, what? Whereas if I say, look, kids need to be out playing football because otherwise they'll start mugging little old ladies or writing graffiti on walls. Now you understand what I'm on about. I had to explain that several times to him. But when he got it, he was thrilled with it. And he was the best student ever because once he got a thing, he would say, now, hold on. And he would repeat it back to you to double check that he had it. And so whenever after that first session he was doing a big debate or doing a big interview, I would be called and he would do a simulation. I never got close to him. I never got close to him. I never called him anything but Mr. Hawhey.
Did he ever express his appreciation?
Oh, yes. That's the other thing that he had over Garrett, oddly. He would always telephone first thing the following morning, round about 7, to say thank you and to say this worked and I'm really grateful for the... He was the most fantastically courteous and appreciative customer.
Even though he thought you were a bitch.
And even though I thought he was a fraud.
Okay, there's so much in the book. It's absolutely fabulous. It's like an iceberg. We've only touched the bit you can see on the surface. You loved Pádraig Flynn, and people can read the book and find out how and why he's a different man to the one that we all saw on that famous Late Late Show interview. The book is called I'm Glad You Asked Me That. It is a hugely entertaining book. Absolutely. Hugely entertaining. I would recommend it as bedside reading to one and all. It's I'm Glad You Asked Me That, The Political Years by Terry Prone. Terry, thank you very much for joining us in the studio.
Thank you.
The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance
on News Talk.